Sarah Carradine.
And I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told.
We'll put documentary features, short stories, and long-running episodic shows under the magnifying glass and examine what true crime stories can tell us about ourselves.
We'll have fascinating guests each week to discuss our true crime passions with new and recent releases, as well as classics.
We'll give you our recommendations and suggestions for more viewings, listenings, and of course, readings on the side. So let's open today's file. We watched Unsolved Mysteries Season 2, Episode 21.
Or Episode 16, depending on how your streamer numbers it.
Yes, exactly.
And to discuss it and all things true crime, we have with us the original television recapper, the OG snark singer from Television Without Pity, the steel trap mind behind Best Evidence FYI, and the owner of Exhibit B Books in Brooklyn, Sarah D. Bunting, no relation.
No relation. I went on Ancestry.com and did the DNA literally only to make sure that it was no relation. And there is no relation to bodies and barrels in Snowtown. I am innocent of all charges.
I'm so happy to hear that. Welcome, Sarah, and perhaps tell our viewers and our listeners why I would say no relation as an Australian.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. And second of all, John Bunting, I believe, is still incarcerated for the Snowtown murders. So it's very rare that anyone catches the connection with the last names, wow, especially here in the States. So occasionally I would make the joke and say no relation and there would just be, you know, blank stares.
Yeah. Yes. We have so few serial killers here in Australia. Well, so few that have actually been captured. So we sort of know their names by rote. I myself was almost run off the road and who knows what would have happened by one of our other famous serial killers, Ivan Milat. And that might be a story for another day.
What was his nickname? Did he have a nickname like a wolf or a slasher or something? That sounds very familiar to me.
The film Wolf Creek kind of draws on
that's
his
what I was
activities.
Thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Wolf Creek,
that's what it was.
Yeah. Set in the outback more. Ivan Milat was a truck driver and he prowled up and down the south coast of New South Wales. He was particularly clever, disgusting, I don't know how you would say it, but he used to get pairs of people, often women, but not always women. And as a young sort of 21-year-old, me and my friend Alison, shout out Alison, were driving in what turned out to be his happy hunting ground at around the time of his happy hunting. And we had a extremely scary, actually I'm getting quite thinking about it, we had an extremely scary kind of 20-minute duel between a truck and my tiny little secondhand Fiat sports coupe.
Oh, my God. And it kind of makes you think it's like run-ins like that. And it's like, what makes us drawn to true crime as like, you know, listeners, watchers, viewers, especially for us, you know, starting a new true crime podcast, there's a million out there, really a million good ones too. Why do you think there's like there's always been a fascination with true crime? What do you think, Sarah?
Well, I have a bunch of grand unifying theories about this that are way above my bachelor's in creative writing. But you asked me on this podcast, you probably won't do it again.
Yes, I did.
But here's one of them, which relates to other Sarah's story, which is that I think that for a lot of consumers of true crime, there is a feeling that knowledge is power. And that if you can just consume a high enough volume in whatever subgenre, whether it's con artists or serial killers or what have you, that you will be able to spot this evil and it will not be chaotic evil and you will be able to avoid it. Of course, when it comes to psychopaths or really con artists, like because we aren't those things, I assume, That it's hard to sort of know the dark heart of someone like that, because it's completely alien to your own experience of actually caring about other people. But I do think that that false, or maybe it's not false, but like that illusion of control, which is mostly an illusion.
Yeah, security. Yeah.
I think is a big part of it. And also just, you know, rubbernecking. Like, let's face it. I'm not above that. Honestly. Oh.
Yeah. I know for me, I'm sorry, Sarah. I was just going to say, I know for me, as somebody who is like, can be very, have lots of anxiety and be very neurotic, that is one of the reasons why I consume true crime.
Sure, sure.
Okay. Well, now I know what to look for. And if this happens, then I can do this, you know, and it is maybe a false insecurity, but it's security, but it does feel like you said, knowledge is power. If you're not
right.
naive to it, that then maybe you can figure it out before it's too late.
Right.
Type thing.
Yeah. I mean, coming from a performing arts background, I sort of see true crime as it can be very satisfying narratively as well, that appeals to something in our, we want to listen to stories. We want to hear stories. We've been telling each other stories, you know, as long as mm-hmm. we've been around. And if there is a satisfying end where the killer or the con artist or whoever it is gets their comeuppance, that's very satisfying. But even in the unsolved mysteries where we don't know, there's something incredibly tantalizing about that. So I think it appeals to that as well. But this idea that we can arm ourselves against these very rare occurrences, while we happily kind of get into cars and get on planes and drink alcohol and do all that.
Right. Other more dangerous things, right?
Well, exactly. Sarah, what do you think is happening with true crime now, the stories that are being told? It seems like it's moving away from that gory, serial killery kind of focus into this more con swindle area.
I think that there's still definitely that market for that serial killer subgenre, I guess, for lack of a better term. But I think also it just goes in phases. Like, we're now back into a con swindler thing, but like when the Anna Sorokin story first broke a few years ago, and it was like the summer of scam, and that's all that anybody was doing. And now Inventing Anna has come out. I think that con artistry in particular, like, that never goes away. That's where people who spend a lot of time sort of in this genre in general go to rest. Like, this is my not happy place, but in order to like soothe myself after reading some disgusting thing involving the trunk of a car and some girl who went missing, that it's like, let's just read about like Flim Flammery in some big compendium from the 70s by J. Robert Nash, because that's always who wrote it back then. Because that's what we had when I was a kid. We had these big doorstop books of like the Encyclopedia of Bunko by J. Robert Nash, whose author photos are fucking amazing, by the way. And you had like documentaries that never came to my town, and you had 2020 and the news and unsolved mysteries starting in the 80s. So I mean, before, I think the internet has really done a lot. This is a value neutral statement to sort of evolve true crime and how we receive it and how we understand it. And I hope that I'm contributing something positive to that with my various ventures. I don't know why certain crimes have a moment. I think it's just like one of those things where, you know, there were two sort of amazing racy shows on at the same time 20 years ago. Like, there was 30 Rock and Studio 60 at the same time. There's something in the collective unconscious that clusters these things. For good or ill.
I wonder if it's like, I mean, because technically the serial killer isn't as easy to pull off nowadays because of all of the DNA technology and stuff like that. Full disclosure, I have a master's in forensic science and a graduate certificate in forensic DNA and serology. So, like, it's way harder these days to try and get away with multiple murders than it was like in the 70s, where everybody was right. It was just a free for all, especially in California. And I think you're
and
right.
It, like, with police departments, first of all, didn't believe in serial killers as a concept. Yes. They're like, oh, it's someone they knew. Like, no. And second of all, they're having to, even if they do figure it out, they're like telexing each other. Like, how did any crimes get solved when you actually had to, like, you know, go out of the house?
Right. And I just think that the cons and the flimflammeries and stuff like that is just, like you said, it's easier because with the internet, it's almost easier to con people without even have to look them in the face. You know, the Tinder swindler comes to mind as well.
Oh, my God. This motherfucker has a Cameo account, I found out yesterday.
Yes.
And he is charging more than all of the stars of Beverly Hills 90210 like put together. The cojones on this guy. Unbelievable.
And he's charging,
eating it up.
Yeah,
$20,000 if you want him to come to your club. A club appearance is $20,000. Although charging $20,000 and someone paying $20,000 remains to be seen.
Yeah, but your wire transfer is on its way. Love, Anna Sorokin.
Love.
This guy. But
that was one, the Tinder swindler, narratively, that was just like incredibly satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll spoil it here because I'm assuming everyone listening to this has already watched it. We're cheering at the end when he gets caught. Hurrah, hurrah. And then that wonderful boom, boom of the, you know, he was out 5 months later. And really, they only got him on money stuff.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with the swindling the ladies stuff. And on he goes with his Bentley and everything. So, yeah, he's still there.
It's kind of frustrating in a sense. Yeah.
Well, everybody knows him now, but I'm sure he will continue his.
But he can, life. I mean, exactly. He can use that as his brand. Like, that is his genius. Mm-hmm. And on a certain level, like, I don't admire it, but I kind of respect it. But it's like, con's gonna con.
Yeah. And people are going to allow him to con and pay him to do things. So it's just like, it's very annoying. And I feel bad for the women because they're just sitting there paying off that debt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, they have no recourse for that. I think they're crowdfunding it, which is just like,
well, that's for those three of them. But what about everybody else? And not only that, being dragged on the internet.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Victim blaming.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah,
victim blaming.
Mm-hmm. So, the Tinder swindler is it's a very new type of crime and style of documentary. But today we're here to talk about unsolved mysteries, and not even just unsolved mysteries, but like the old school unsolved mysteries, the stackisodes. We pointed out, this is season 2, episode 21 on Amazon Prime. It could be episode 16, depending on where you're getting it. But this is about the first story is about Georgia Rudolph, who believes she is the reincarnation of Sandra Jenkins, who committed suicide in 1914. It's also about either a murder or suicide of a rookie cop named Steve Sandland. And that's an unsolved case. And then finally, it was a all points bulletin for John Thumper Brown, who is a meth cook. So SDB, Sarah Bunting, why did you bring us this unsolved mysteries? Because we let our guests pick some of the properties, and we let you pick a property. Why did you pick this property specifically?
Because my husband, Dan Patrick Brady, plays an undercover cop in the last segment. He's the one jumping out of the passenger side of that red Mustang and probably mishandling his firearm. But anyway, it was, you know, I think this aired in like early 1990. So he's got like the 80s, like feathery hair, the very snug dungarees. My husband and I met on OkCupid, and on our first date, he was like, oh, well, you know, I'm your worst nightmare. I'm divorced. I'm an actor. And I was like, oh, have you done anything I would have heard of? And he mentions unsolved mysteries. I start peppering him with questions. Then I'm like, oh, my God, that's the fucking coolest thing I ever heard. Were you a ghost? Were you someone's secret twin? Did you get to meet Robert Stack? And he's like, I don't appreciate your making fun of me. And I was like, pathetically, I am not making fun of you. I'm legitimately interested. I get home
and the rest is history.
Yeah, I had been churning through these dates, and my sister-in-law, with whom I lived at the time, was like, So I was like, he was on Unsolved Mysteries. And she's like, Choir of Angels, it's destiny. And it was. That was 10 years ago. And we're still very happy. And Unsolved Mysteries is still a big part of our lives. But this episode actually was something that I had to go to the internet to crowdsource finding it, because he couldn't remember, like he could remember what he did and basically the outlines of the case, but they were not good about the credits back then. And I was just combing through, and finally I just gave it to my then podcast listeners. I was like, somebody's got to find this. And someone found it in like 2 hours. I love the internet. Never change internet.
It's the best.
It is. But that's why we're watching this one. I was not aware that fully like 55% of the runtime would be taken up with this crackpot nonsense about this lady.
Yeah.
Who is cold reading so broadly with these like very common names like John Thompson, that they're still like, we couldn't find a record of anyone with that name in all of whatever Carolina they're in. And I'm like, girl, just drop it. But she was committed. So
committed. And I wish we had visual aids, because the garage doors on that woman are a sight to behold. Remembering this is 1990. She's cold reading. If people don't know what cold reading is, A, look it up. But B, it's basically picking up cues, and it's what fake psychic.
I see a J in a body of water. Like, oh, honey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a scar on your knee from an accident when you were a child.
What are the odds?
But also people do it deliberately. These are the fake psychics, or psychics as I call them, use cold reading quite deliberately and are extremely skillful. People tend to remember the hits and not the misses, and they take information that you give them. For example, I hear a J. Oh yes, my grandfather was Jack. Yes, your grandfather was called Jack. Oh my god, she told me that my grandfather was called Jack. This is how people's minds work. But people like this poor lady, Georgia Rudolph, I don't know if she knows she's cold reading, but for example, we hear that she feels she's the reincarnation of a young girl, and she goes to a place and sees a house and finds a cemetery, and in her vision there was a pointing angel. What are the odds?
In a cemetery.
She tells us that she drowned in the river behind the house, and then later we hear that descendants of people who lived in the house showed her a photograph and pointed out a girl who drowned in the river behind the house. And we are supposed to go, oh, how incredible. But the program doesn't tell us what order those things happened in.
Yes.
And this is one of the things about cold reading. That girl who looks like all the other girls in the photograph, she looks very familiar. Yes, she drowned behind the house. Yes, I had a vision of drowning behind the house. I don't know that she knows she's doing it, but I think that we're given a very slight glimpse into the fact that she was adopted when she was 5, which is really tough. A very close friend of mine was also adopted when she was 5, and those little creatures carry a lot of stuff from that first 5 years and from the adoption. I don't want to play armchair psychologist, but she's certainly a searcher for belonging. What did you think of this?
So this reminded me why I stayed away from Unsolved Mysteries as a kid.
Like,
for me, being young, I hated Unsolved Mysteries. I hated America's Most Wanted because me as a kid, I'm like, oh, that person's coming to get me. Whoever it is, they're coming to get me. If you're looking for them, they're coming to get me for no reason at all. So when I first turned this on, I'm like, is this the one we were supposed to be watching at first? Because it truly was. Most of the runtime was this Georgia Rudolph lady trying to prove she was reincarnated. But it truly didn't make sense. Like Sarah said, like the first she doesn't know the girl's name, but then she does find out the girl's name. She goes to Ohio, and then they show the picture of the girl and her family. But then they say that they don't know the girl's name in the picture, and that everybody in the picture is credited except for the one girl. So is this who she's claiming to be? And did she kill herself because her boyfriend died and she was unwed and pregnant? It was It was a lot.
Yeah.
For me, it was a lot. The main thing it had me thinking about was reincarnation. And I'm spiritual. I'm a spiritual Christian, but not like a churchgoer to that extent. And I was just like, I don't like the sound of any of this. Like, I don't like,
yeah,
reincarnation does not speak to me personally. So that creeped me out. I was like, oh man, I don't like this.
Well, I didn't mind it. Here's the gift of being able to watch the old school Unsolved Mysteries on streaming is that if it's one of those segments about like, but no, aliens were in my dupa, like they weren't, but I don't have to sit through this because it's not 1989. And I can just skip to the next segment. Thank God.
Yeah.
And I did watch this at a higher speed. Like, I have a lot of compassion for Georgia Rudolph and for the people who don't feel like they belong anywhere. So they attach to occasional incidents that might suggest that they have second sight as a way to feel like they belong in some world, even if it's not this one. And that was a lot of look that she was in, and this, like, the internet is forever. But I also must say this is an excellent example of Robert Stack extremely gravely intoning about things that are just a fucking coincidence and that's it, but imbuing them with import, and he never cheats the subject. Like, even if it's just like the most outlandish thing that's like, she was never seen again, like, he gives it 110% every time. I miss him.
He scared me.
Yeah,
he scared me as a kid.
Me too.
He's the reason.
And that and that theme song, that key change right at the end, I mean, it's my ringtone, so obviously I don't find it that bothersome, but
yes, yeah. Robert Stack is a very impressive man, and he looks us straight in the eye through the camera. Mm-hmm.
And his trench coat.
He makes these statements. And in this one, he was walking through a kind of an airy, warehousey, churchy, something. Yeah, as an atheist, reincarnation is a way of storytelling in some spiritual cultures. For me, this is it. We go back where we came from, basically. If you think about what you knew before you were conceived, that's where we go, as far as I'm concerned. But I do like connections, and I do like the stories that we tell ourselves, and normally people just say, oh, I feel an affinity for that period, or they like to dress in a slightly old-fashioned way, and this is ways that we make ways of belonging. And then for Georgia, it's just a step further to say, I lived there. This was me. The first thing for me was when she said her name was Sandra, and I said, darling, you were born in 1895.
Yeah.
I don't think your name was Sandra.
Yeah, that's a great point of just kind of wanting to be somewhere else almost. But I did like the second story. So the second story was about Steve Sandlin, who was a rookie cop who had only been on the job for 8 weeks before he was found shot to death in the police station that he worked. And his whole family felt like it was not suicide. It was initially ruled like accidental, maybe suicide. It was like unresolved. It was like what's the word? They said they couldn't figure it out, basically. And but his mom was like, no, he wouldn't have killed himself. He was on the phone with his girlfriend, like 45 minutes before anybody was alerted to his death, talking about what they were going to do the next day. And then he was found dead. And then, I was waiting for them to go more into the forensics of it all, but
yeah, I was going to mention,
they kind of glossed over it. Yeah.
Yeah. That it was like, you know, presumably there were some forensics. I forget if it was gunpowder residue or blood spatter or perhaps both, but it just suggested that the gun, his gun was next to him. And of course, they assumed that's the weapon, and I guess the ballistics matched, but it suggested that it had been fired from like 10 feet away versus, like, if he had done it, why wouldn't it be point blank range?
Like
Mm-hmm. And I believe
the body was moved.
Right. And then it just seemed like it just seemed bizarre. And especially since he had had disagreements with one of the locals who, you know, Sandlin was very proactive and would like wait outside of bars for people to get behind the wheel drunk, which, okay.
right.
Pulled someone over. There was a search warrant. They found a like gazillion pounds of marijuana in guy's house. And apparently this community in New Mexico, Mountain Air, is, you know, close to what was then an illegal growing sort of like Humboldt situation. And I think that Sandlin, it was, you know, Sandlin was told to chill. He had no chill and maybe was killed. And this was reclassified as a homicide in 1995. Yeah. But I did some Googling around and it's still not solved. And
yeah, the latest thing I read was from the New Mexico Independent 2019. No one's ever been prosecuted. The crime remains unsolved. And Reddit, as of a year ago, also agrees unsolved. I mean, it's interesting the idea of that police might have been involved. So a higher up thought, no, it wasn't suicide, and he was fired. And then another one apparently resigned over this case. I wonder in 1990 if that was a much more shocking idea, that the police might have been involved in some kind of wrongdoing. Whereas here in Australia, or certainly in my state of New South Wales, we used to say New South Wales police, the best police force money can buy. Mm. They were famously incredibly corrupt in the 80s and 90s and are somewhat cleaner now, as much as any police, you know, any force of any kind can be. So I'm going to ask you, as Americans, was this a more rare idea or a less accepted idea in the 90s that, or the very late 80s, that police could have been corrupt?
Well, looking at the makeup of that town, I think they even said, including him, there was only four police officers in the town itself.
Yeah.
In it being a like a border, it sounded like it was kind of like a border town, like STD said, maybe a growing town. Because one of the strange facts was after his death, the police like went through his house. They checked everything. They looked for evidence, all that good stuff. When his family came to collect his belongings 3 days later, they found pounds of marijuana just in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah, like, not well like, hidden, how apparently. Could this,
they're like, how could this be here if the police said they thoroughly searched this house 3 days ago? So it definitely suggested that this is a large operation operating in this town, and somebody probably thought, hey, this house is probably abandoned because the guy is, you know, dead. This might be a good place to hide some stuff for a while before, you know, if they have to move it around. But before they could do that, the family got there and saw it. Mm. So it does feel like I can believe this. Now, back in the day in that area, you know, I think they even had the police chief on this show talking about how people were saying like he might have been there in that morning. He was like, no, I was at a public function with 200 people.
And the way that he was defensive about that, I found was very interesting, that he's like, whoever is saying that is a liar. Like, why don't you just say they must be mistaken? Say that you have that, you know, you had an alibi and leave it there. But he was so specific and pissed off about this, and I was like, something about you is dodgy. And also the victim's father was a cop, I think still was a cop when he went on the show with Albuquerque PD. So it's like, this sounds like a message to me, but I don't like watching it back then. I don't think anyone was terribly sophisticated about the copaganda concept, which like most of Unsolved Mysteries, the crime portion, like, is that there is like a heavy overlap with America's Most Wanted, which like is fine, but you just have to be eyes open about what it is and who it's for. But I'm from New Jersey. So the idea that like government is corrupt It's like, and?
Yeah, and?
Like, the whole police force of my town had to resign because they raided the high school looking for guidance counselor files mentioning kids who smoked pot. So...
Yeah, that's not very good.
No, it's bad. It's bad. It's a felony, I think, actually, and certainly now would be a HIPAA violation, but...
Yes.
Jersey. Yes. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, so no closure for the family as far as finding out who did it, but certainly having the crime changed to murder, I think, would have solved their minds somewhat, as they didn't want him to be labelled a suicide. And, in fact, there's been a memorial and he's now listed as killed on duty. Mm. So... Some small resolve for them. Should we talk about John Thumper Brown? Thumper. The Walter White of his day. John Thumper Brown was a meth cook, and he was a meth cook for a motorcycle club called the Hessians. And I did a little Googling. I went on the Hessians website. Who knew?
They have a website.
Just a whole website.
Guys, you're doing it wrong. It's just my opinion.
You're slightly wrong. Yes. If you want to browse photographs of
Santibus High School Football Rules.com.
Oh,
what idiots.
I'm so confused.
But their slogan, I might read for you. Readers with delicate sensibilities might like to mute me briefly as I tell you this is their slogan. Harleys were a lot more fun when they were exclusively ridden by angry, violent, intoxicated, antisocial, poorly groomed, sexually deviant, heavily tattooed maniacs! Exclamation mark. We believe in quality, not quantity. We respect those who respect us.
Okay.
Police?
Sure.
So I can get them. What is that?
Yeah,
Hashtag buy American. That's
yeah.
Here's what made me laugh about this segment, aside from seeing my husband in the full skin tight Levi's flower of his youth, was that the pictures that they showed of the real Thumper, this is. Mm. And I mean no disrespect to those who suffer and struggle with substance misuse, but this is the methiest looking person I've ever seen in my life. And he has a Hessian's ringer tee on. Are you on the lam or not? Buddy.
Not at all.
Not like not even. I mean, the shirt was
not
actually kind of cool. Except for, you know, the Iron Cross iconography was a problem. But like, I do like a ringer tee. Yeah. Don't need the logo. But, oh, man, like this guy. And then he'd just be like, well, I'll just, you know, set up somewhere else and buy another 28 tons of acetone. And then the federal government's like, even we can catch you, buddy.
But they had to catch him several times.
Yeah.
He kept eluding
them. Right?
Yeah. So his thing is he seemed to be quite highly regarded within these circles, that he would cause other people to set the kitchen up for him. Mm-hmm. He didn't like to sweat too much, we're told. He liked to just come in, cook the meth and go. And he was producing a lot of meth. And I think it's the same with the marijuana value as well. The value, the dollar value amounts in 1990 dollars were really quite something to hear, even then, let alone translating them to their value now. So, you know, this is why crime is attractive to Thumper and his ilk. There's a very nice group of reenactment actors who scatter out of a caravan. They're in marvelous outfits. There's a woman with a fringed vest and flying blonde hair that I kind of thought, oh, that looks like fun. No. I think they're a bit cleaner, perhaps, than the reenactment actors are perhaps slightly cleaner.
Mm-hmm. But only slightly.
Yeah, he truly was just Walter White. Like, I think they said he was making, like $1.1 million worth of meth could be made in some of those labs that he had set up. So, I mean, he definitely looked like a user, but clearly he was smart enough to also be able to make a lot of money off of it. But the good thing is we got the update. He was captured on February 24th, 1990. He was arrested in Las Vegas, Nevada, due to a tip from a female companion. Mm-hmm. And he was convicted on drug manufacturing charges, sentenced to 30 years in prison. And he was paroled in 2016.
He's out.
Is he listening to this?
Oh, man. And I love that, like, without the thumper part, his name is John Brown. So, John Brown, wherever your body is.
No.
At us.
Don't come here.
Let us know.
We like your t-shirts. Mm-hmm. Maybe a line of merch. Maybe if you're on the straight and narrow, a line of merch. I sort of think things like this, and I thought this about the Tinder swindler as well. Like, how much work went into that con? How much work goes into sort of manufacturing illegal drugs and the cost and the amount of work? And I don't want to be Calvinist about it, but why don't you just get a real job and work really hard?
I feel like this comes up a lot. I was just reading a sort of monograph by the recently late Janet Malcolm about it's called The Crime of Sheila McGuff. And Sheila McGuff was the attorney herself later in legal trouble for this real estate con artist. So Malcolm has a long disquisition about the nature of con artists and the fact that we do call them artists. And that their artistry is important to them. But I think this is a question that comes up a lot with, you know, a lot of sort of short-term victimless, like non-violent felonious behavior that it's like, why don't you just get a real job? Like, I don't know, the real job that I had when I would have been watching this when it originally aired was, and I was the assistant manager of this card store, but it was a card store in the mall and I made $5.35 an hour. Like, if I could have come up with a fun con. And maybe. So I think that's part of the appeal sometimes about true crime, not just controlling chaotic evil, but in the case of some of these crimes that are not psychotic, that and not like, you know, sadism, that there is this appeal to like, well, if I had to, I could set up a big store con. Like there is something not aspirational, but I mean, maybe aspirational that it's like, all right, if I had to, apparently there's people who don't know how wire transfers work. I can get short term quote loan of $250,000 and just beat feet.
Yeah.
It's kind of like to me is like if you're scamming a corporation or an institution or something like that, I'm more down for that than like individuals, like ruining the whole individual's credit. It makes me think of the coupon. Do y'all remember the coupon?
Yes.
Like that scam. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll that was a really pretty funny movie. I saw that movie. Maybe that's something we can add to the list. But like something like that, I was like, yes, Queens, go take the corporation's money. I could do that. I could print out all these coupons and sell them.
Or like the McMillian scam. Like, I don't need somebody's 76-year-old nana who's on a fixed income to be like, you know, having to live in her car because she read something. It was like, the Spanish prisoner sounds right to me. Let's just write a check.
The refund scan, go and get a gift card. Yeah. But there is something about like the opening scene of Ocean's 8, Sandy Bullock there recently released from prison, and she goes into the department store and she goes along and she selects lovely cosmetics. And you think, she's not going to be able to return these. She goes to return them. The assistant says, oh, no, you can't return them without a receipt. And we think, she's so great after all. And she goes, oh, fine, well, just give me a bag to carry them in. And she walks out of the store with them, and you go, oh, that's just so, that's so nice. And I didn't see it coming. And it's just, we have the pleasure watching it of being conned ourselves. Others might have been ahead of me, but I was certainly that just that satisfying little slight bit behind, so that I was very pleased. So there's something very elegant about that. And because it was cosmetics and because we feel big stores. So not that I've ever shoplifted in my life, but if I had shoplifted, it would always have been from big departments. Stores, because if I had done it, I would have felt like, ah, it's this big department store. You know, that there's no victim here. Of course, as we know, there absolutely is. But I wonder if it's the lure of the money first, or the bent towards naughtiness or badness first for these kind of
right crimes. Or of course, systems that are not. Systems that are not supporting the non-standard creative capitalist, for lack of a better term.
Okay, well, I'm writing that down.
That's a nice job.
The bespoke idea generator. Like, I don't know. I mean, disruption is great if venture capitalists can understand it and be conned. To their own benefit themselves. I mean, you know, bad blood is, and that whole Elizabeth Holmes story, I think, is fascinating for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think that some of it is, how can we avoid being grifted ourselves? But then some of it is like, okay, but how, like, this is when you want your true crime to be really processy. Like, how was this grift accomplished? Please go back, like in Ocean's 11, which I basically have memorized at this point, and show us, like, from soup to nuts, like, we know where that little tree is hanging in the van. Like, go back and show us how they did this. And so that, you know, we can catch up at the same time as Terry Benedict. And, like, I mean... Yeah, if it's well done and well constructed, I think it comes back to what you, other Sarah, said earlier about wanting to impose narrative on the chaos of life, that whatever story we're able to bring out of it is useful, whether it's because it's soothing or because it's entertaining or because it's inspiring or because it's empowering. So hopefully, like... You know, wives with knives on the Oxygen Channel. Okay, that's not really the kind of thing we're talking about. But I think that that's what you can, or what I tell myself, true crime can do for us as a culture.
SDB, I think you're giving us so many recommendations that we're like writing down that we're going to have to think about covering. But until then, let's get to the recommendations for Unsolved Mysteries here. So, like we said, you can find Unsolved Mysteries, the Robert Shack and Dennis Farina seasons on Amazon Prime. What we'll do is we'll link in our show notes and descriptions where you can find the episodes, because we want to just make sure we can make them accessible to everybody who's listening to the US and Australia, because that is where Sarah is coming from. So we'll make sure if you're confused about where to look or where to watch, you can look into our show notes to find links to the episodes. So, SDB, would you recommend Unsolved Mysteries? What would you give this episode of Unsolved Mysteries and the series as a whole out of 5 magnifying glasses, 5 being you heavily recommend it, 1 being, you know, let's talk about something else. What would you give this Unsolved Mysteries?
This particular episode, subtracting my husband's fine form from it, it's sort of not all that typical, because the breakout of the segments is a little unusual, and Georgia Rudolph was sort of a pitiable figure and not really my jam. Not quite enough ghosts, but no aliens. So 3.5 magnifying glasses for this episode, and the series overall. I mean, bless Dennis Farina's mustached heart, but that was not a success for me. I have really liked the reboot. I thought they have been smart about how they did that.
Yes.
I mean, if this kind of thing is for you and you have this nostalgia for it that I have, but otherwise, but then again, it's not, if it's not for you, it's not. At the time, I would have said three because you couldn't skip the like UFO, like that, you know, this Philadelphia tavern is haunted. No, it isn't. It's just board settling. So yeah, I would say four overall in this episode, 3.5. Yeah. And my husband's segment, five. Go, Dan.
Five. Yes. Five. Sarah, how about you?
Well, very similar. I would go slightly lower on the magnifying glasses for this episode because of poor Georgia. I'm going to give it three for the episode. But for the series, and like Sarah, I'm in the Stackisodes, the Farina, not for me. I think it's a high, if you like it, it's a high 4.5. It's something you can have on as you're pottering around. And because there are segments, you can dip in and out as you do. Oh, I like this. I'll stand with my cleaning cloth in my hand and watch that bit. As soon as I heard that music, I was just sort of soothed and excited in the same measure. I was so happy to see him. I was happy to hear him. You know, as we've said, and doesn't need to be said again, but apparently I'm going to, the Georgia Rudolph, it really overshadows this particular episode, but I think it's unusual for that. Yeah. I think the new ones are really, really interesting. Obviously, the production levels are in a completely different world, but there's something about the measured pace of them, something about the total seriousness of them that is soothing, like the old ones. So yeah, so three magnifying glasses for the episode, 4.5 for the series, and I'll give four to the new ones. What about you, Mari?
Yes. Okay. That's a great segue because I'll definitely say we're all pretty low on this episode in general. So for me, I will stick with the three magnifying glasses for the episode. For me, I'll also give three magnifying glasses for the series as a whole, because like I said, it just wasn't my thing. And like you guys said, it's either your thing or it's not, kind of. And that's perfectly fine. That's the reason why we have this podcast, because we can love to see the different perspectives and stuff. So remembering my lack of nostalgia for the earlier seasons,
right?
I'm gonna keep it at a three. But however, I like this segue into what we could recommend that is like the property that we're watching. So I think kind of grouping the new Unsolved Mysteries into almost a different category by itself, because me, those I watch them as soon as they dropped on Netflix. Yep. I was all in for volume two, and they speak to me in a different way than watching these ones do. So I kind of want to introduce it as its own kind of property. And I would definitely, this is where we can give like some non-spoiler suggestions for other stuff that we like to watch, or that we think people who like this episode might watch. I know I'm putting both of you guys on the spot there with that, but I think the newer Unsolved Mysteries are really good. And I feel like maybe it's because they only really focus, each episode only focuses on one case.
Yeah,
and I think that because it was what, like six episodes or something like in the first season, I gotta look it up, but it wasn't that many episodes. They are all individual cases. And I remember when the first batch came out, I think I was like, okay, that one looks interesting, I'll watch that one. That one looks interesting, I'll watch that one. And then later I went back to, I was like, okay, well, I don't have anything else to do. Let me watch the ones that I wasn't completely interested in, because they ran the gamut of the different crimes. So I would definitely suggest, if you liked watching this, try out the new Unsolved Mysteries that are on Netflix, if you have access to Netflix. SDB? Any other recommendations?
Yeah, I absolutely would recommend the new Unsolved Mysteries. And when I was reviewing it, whenever it first debuted, I guess a couple of years ago, when I was watching the credits and that smoke resolved to be the silhouette of Robert Stack, I almost started weeping. It was sort of early in the pandemic, I think. And I it didn't take much for me to start weeping, but I was just like, Stacky, how you doing? So yeah, those are really well done. And if you like the older school like anthology feel of these, and also an extremely committed narrator, old school Forensic Files, not the new one, the old yes. one with that narrator who was like mm-hmm. apparently a decorated World War II flying ace. This guy, I believe his name's Peter Thomas. Mm-hmm. He lived to be like 95. He is no longer with us on this side of the veil, but mm-hmm. there's something about like it's a lot of very obvious B-roll and everything is all settled in like 23 minutes, but it's always on somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it is, to me, very soothing. And the way he pronounces the word murder is just something. So old school Forensic Files, which is like, I think that might be on Hulu.
It's on Netflix as well.
Yeah, yeah. You can find that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And anything, any true crime series or property that was produced or directed by a guy named Joshua Zeman has a very similar Ooh. Sort of feel to the new Unsolved Mysteries. I would say to start with a property from a few years back called Murder Mountain, which was about the Humboldt growing community and sort of organized and other crimes in that area. It's extremely well done. And the Sandlin case from what we just talked about made me think of that. So Zeman, Zeman, his first feature was about the Cropsey legend in Staten Island. And I am getting the little hairs okay. are sticking up just thinking about it still. So he's a gooder.
Nice. Okay. Okay. Sarah, any other recommendations?
Yes, I also recommend the current Unsolved Mysteries. I am a bad crime podcaster because I'm trying to think of the Australian series, and Australian viewers will be shouting at me, that looks at various different big crime stories in Australia. I'll put it in the show notes. They do one that is not so good about the vice queens that ran the Sydney underworld in the 20s and 30s. There were two very big women who big in terms of their reach and their power in the 20s and 30s. That's very interesting. But also the Roger Rogerson stuff, who was our sort of premier gold standard corrupt cop, and various other ones. So I will put that in the show notes. I was desperately Googling, but my mind is a blank on that. But they're really good. They are docudramas, so they are reenactments, but some of them are very well written and directed, and they can be enjoyable.
Right. Yeah, I love that. And at Crime Scene, we are eager to hear your feedback. So if you have any suggestions for future episodes, you can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's SEEN, or email us Crime Scene RHAP at gmail.com. Okay, great.
Yes. So, Sarah, what do you have going on, and where can people find you?
Well, you can find my reviews with my writing partner, Eve Beatty, at our crime review newsletter. We're reviewing the properties about the crimes, not the crimes themselves. Crimes are bad. That's why we call them crimes, and not taking a nap or candy. That is at Best Evidence. FYI, we review new stuff. We review old stuff. It is a very busy true crime prestige limited series spring. So if you're wondering what we thought about stuff like The Girl from Plainville or The Thing About Pam or The Thin Blue Line, like that's all there. We do a lot of that. Best Evidence. FYI. And sometimes there's ancillary materials that people would like to look up or buy in book form. I got you covered there, too. ExhibitBbooks.com. And you fine listeners can get a discount on anything that you find there. I also have old magazines, random pamphlets about stopping commercial burglaries. There's a lot of good stuff. Look through it. See if you find anything you like. That code at checkout is XCS15. That's XCS15. And there is a link directly to that in the show notes that will just throw that in your cart and you get 15% off.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's wonderful. And what about you, Mari? What have you got going on, and where can people find you?
Of course, I am one of the hosts of the Wrestling Rehab Up podcast, where we over on RHAP, where we, me and Matt Scott GW, Twitter, I plug his Twitter and my Twitter all at the same time. But we talk about wrestling, WWE, AEW. We give you the highlights of the week. You don't even have to be a wrestling fan. You just come and hear us talk about wrestling. So follow me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much, to like the number two, to see where we'll be popping up at, and to follow us on our follow our wrestling podcast. I will also be doing BB Can 10 coverage on RHAP as well. So if you follow me, you'll know what I'm doing. Sarah, where can the people find you?
They can find me on unceded Gadigal land here in Sydney, Australia. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter. I'm recapping Bridgerton, and soon Our Flag Means Death for post-show recaps. I'm very excited about that because I love a pirate story.
Okay.
And any Round the Twist fans, there's something quite special coming your way very soon, so stay tuned for that. So next time on Crime Scene, we will call the great LaTonya Starks to the witness stand. We're going to discuss A Crime to Remember, Season 2, Episode 2, Shock Doctor. You can find it in the US on Amazon Prime. I had to pay $1.99 for it on YouTube in Australia, cheap at five times the price.
Speaking of crimes.
I don't know if it also is on Discovery Plus as well here in the US. I guess we will check and see where you can find it internationally. Again, you can refer to our show notes, but yes, watch that and then come listen to us discuss it. It's going to be great. Thanks to our sublime guest, Sarah.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, letting me ramble on. This is my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Fun. This was so fun. Yes, and definitely support her. Use the special link in our show notes to get some discounts on some books. Special thanks to Peter Miller, who is a noted skeptic. That's her Sarah. Shout out.
I had a long conversation with him. I made him watch the Georgia Rudolph. So, Peter, you are my eternal friend. He watched it, and he took it to pieces. He dismantled it beat by beat. So if you're interested in that, hit me up and I will show you through Peter exactly what was happening as far as what we saw. So that was amazing. Thanks to Will from America for the theme music, and to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes.
Yep. Until next time,
case closed.